Hello, fanatical Remainists. Welcome to a public information podcast on behalf of Her Majesty's Government. I'm Andrew Harrison, the producer of the show, and I'm delighted to be able to tell you that Remainiacs has won the tender for a sizeable chunk of that sweet, sweet £100 million in government funding for no-deal preparation information. In conjunction with our friends at Number 10 and Tufton Street, the podcast will now pivot to bring you all the latest on what you can do to take full advantage of the opportunities that no-deal will inflict, I'm sorry, bring to Britain. So hold tight for how to make tea from pencil shavings, the joy of queuing, insulin, who needs it, fun with rickets, and much, much more. Never let it be said that we can't be flexible. Meanwhile, back in the real world, this week we'll be looking at the latest efforts to make no deal seem inevitable from our undemocratic Leave EU government, so you two can play at that game, after Sajid Javid decided to troll the nation by reactivating that commemorative Brexit 50p coin, sure to be worth at least a quarter euro by Halloween. We're going to be thinking of useful things to do if you get a shiny Boris in your change. And are we at the beginning of the end game? August feels like the top of the roller coaster. If we've got to go down the slope, what should we be concentrating on and what's going to make a difference? It's a guest-free show this week, so brace yourself for diatribes. Hello to regular panellist Naomi Smith, Chief Executive of Best for Britain and the hardest working woman in Remain. How are you, Naomi?
Yeah, I'm good, but don't let people like Caroline Lucas and Heidi Allen hear you say that.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, you know, I mean, we bestow the accolades as we see fit. So something that's happened this week, the People's Vote, the big march, the Let Us Be Heard march, is being moved from October the 12th to October the 19th. This is important for listeners because they need to know where to be and when. What happened there? Why are we moving the date?
Because it clashed with a Great Ormond Street charity fundraiser marathon. So it was either go ahead and potentially cause disruption or force them effectively to move their biggest fundraiser of the year or change the date. I think the reason behind why that happened and that the date got released before People's Vote fully checked what else was happening and getting all their permissions was because they wanted to get out ahead of the March for Change announcement that was about the march that happened in July. Yeah. So they, if you remember, they announced this one a couple of days ahead of that one, and they probably hadn't done quite as many checks as ordinarily they would do before releasing a date. So it's now going to be after the EU summit, which a lot of people have been a bit upset about, but sort of more importantly than anything is that lots and lots of people, of course, have already booked their travel, their accommodation, some of which will be non-transferable. So there is also going to be a static rally happening on the original date called Rally for Our Rights. So people who want to be able to do something and are in that position where they can't change their travel arrangements can still go to Parliament Square on the 12th for Rally for Our Rights. So you can look them up on Twitter. That's being organised by some of the grassroots.
And it's happening, it could well be happening in the sort of dying days of a general election campaign. So it's not necessarily a bad date. It could be.
No, it could end up being very serendipitous. And actually, one of the last People's Vote marches was, as it turned out, it wasn't when it was originally announced, just a few days before a huge vote in Parliament on the meaningful vote. So, yes, it could well be very good timing. Of course, with a general election, you're then into a regulated period where it's very, very difficult for campaigns to put on political events of this scale and magnitude because of the spending limits that apply. So it may be that the speaker list would have to change. We certainly couldn't then have lots of MPs standing on the stage saying, oh, you must vote for my party this week or next week or whenever it's going to be. Or indeed, the march might end up being a couple of days after a general election. There's been a lot of gossip and a lot of screen grabs of supposed leaked emails showing that Boris Johnson might be trying to move a general election on the 4th of September to call it for the 17th of October. So we may well have the march immediately after a general election.
October 19th, get it in your diaries. It's not the 12th, it's the 19th. Also with us is Alex Andreo, writer, commentator, actor, singer, gentleman at large. Hello, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you.
Listeners' ears were probably burning this week when The Guardian put out a long read having a go at Remainists, a term we hadn't heard before. Remainists. Oh, you had thoughts about this, I believe.
Oh, Lord, it was like one of those films that is about 2 hours too long, but then you've watched about an hour, so you've invested in it, so you need to see how it turns out, and it turns out it doesn't turn out, it doesn't have a point, it's just a sort of collection of quotes.
It was an odd read, was it? Ian was in it, so a lot of weird quotes, very, very weird quotes, very, very weird people. It seemed to sort of set out to prove that, you know, that all these Remainers are all fanatical and uncompromising and weird. And what are they all going to do after Brexit happens? It did seem to be slightly have an agenda.
Oh, God, that's such a ghastly trope, isn't it? The idea that Remain has given purpose to my life where there was none before. And I will be forlorn when it's gone, you know. Yeah, I'll be really sad when mum's healthcare in Greece goes back to costing me 600 quid instead of 800 quid and I don't have to worry about being deported or things like getting medicine. That'll be a sad day.
Also, ensuring that we're quiet this week, it's Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk, and that man sighing on the Sky Papers review every other night. Hello, Ian. How are you doing?
Hello, very well.
Do you think Remainists is going to catch on? It's an odd thing, isn't it? It's like Islamist. They're not Remainers, so. They're Remainists.
No. I think Ramonas is quite dug in, isn't it, really? Remaniacs went away. Was that because... is that me being solipsistic? Was that because of us?
We reclaimed it, man. We made it. We made it cool.
Yeah. I mean, certainly at the beginning it seemed to go that way. Now it's just Ramonas. But either way, I don't think Ramonas is catching on.
It's not going to catch on.
So I was calling myself a Euromaniac for
Euromaniac.
Years, long before the referendum result. Yeah. That's how I describe myself.
By the way, isn't it time that the BBC in particular retired Eurosceptic? They're not sceptics, they're Europhobes. Yeah. It's like this is like a dead word.
Yeah.
Ian, the past couple of weeks have been a bit depressing, but in the past few days we've had Tory moderates coming out harder against No Deal, Phil Hammond breaking cover, Burko saying he's going to ensure Parliament gets to say, are you feeling any more optimistic at the moment?
Yeah, I don't really understand why everyone's being quite so down in the dumps, to be honest. None of the options have changed. So I was listening today on the radio to the Today programme. They have like two pundits, one's pro-No Deal, one's against No Deal, and both of them agree, oh, there's nothing Parliament can do to stop it. And you sort of think like, how on earth is it that you have managed to reach this conclusion? It's not as if you're not being imaginative. It's we literally, this year, saw MPs demonstrate the manner in which you stopped No Deal. They took control of the timetable. They passed legislation. Those options are still there. There's a variety of ways in which it can be done. And the numbers are, if anything, more promising. Because now the people, you know, like Philip Hammond all over the radio this morning, and Rory Stewart, for instance, that previously would have had to keep to the government position, are now on the back benches. So on all of this, I sort of think, like, are we really so lacking in confidence that all the Dominic Cummings, you know, a man who clearly just seems like he's working through his own personal issues and therefore projects his anger onto the rest of the country, comes out and gives a couple of headlines to the Telegraph and everyone's like, oh, that's it, we're doomed, we're fucked. So I think we're demonstrably not fucked. And I think it'd be quite helpful if people started, you know, giving up that idea.
Well, we'll be discussing this in more detail later. So stand by for more undemocratic no-dealery, undemocratic 50-pence pieces, undemocratic airlifts and rapid rebuttals. And even special treat for you, Ian, a bit of Hayek, if you're lucky, if you're good.
Oh, nice.
After these quick reminders from Alex.
A note for your diary. We apologise, but for reasons too boring to go into, next week's podcast will go out a little later than usual on Friday evening. That's Friday the 23rd of August, rather than the usual Thursday evening or Friday morning. And we'll do our best to get it to you in time for your ride home from work. Normal service will be resumed the following week, we promise. One thing that is happening next week is that we're recording part one of our monthly extra podcast for Patreon supporters, Ask Remaniacs. Sign up to support us on the $5 tier or upwards to get a special extra show where our panel answers your questions. Tweet your questions to @RemaniacsCast with hashtag AskRemaniacs or mail them to info@Remaniacs.com and we'll ask the best ones. Patreon backers also get early bird access to our live shows, announcement coming soon, hint, hint, as well as our famous mugs, T-shirts and other benefits. It's the best way to keep us in rude health. Search Patreon Remaniacs to find out more. And if you need to take your mind off politics for a while, you might like our sibling podcast, Big Mouth, the quality pop culture talk show. This week they're discussing Jeremy Deller's brilliant BBC 4 documentary about the glory days of raving Everybody in the Place, plus Sky's new teen angst drama Euphoria, and much more. It's the best pop culture talk on the internet. Search Big Mouth on your favourite app and subscribe.
Thanks, Alex. Right, now, the no-deal smokescreen. It feels an awful lot like Dominic Cummings' Information Warfare Secretariat is trying to pummel us into submission with endless announcements, both great and small, both real and unreal. Say what you like about them, there's a lot going on. But what matters and what is just chaff to distract us while the clock runs down? Don't worry, you've got the optimistic stuff at the end of the show, but let's do the misery first. Ian, This week, for instance, we've seen announcements ranging from 10,000 extra prison places to bailouts for companies threatened with collapse because of no deal to potential Berlin airlifts of food and medicine in the event of no deal. And we're even going to talk about the Brexit 50p later. How much of this is real policy and how much is just designed to give the impression of action or to put the likes of us into a flat spin?
No, it's not really real. I mean, like, your spider sense should always tingle whenever you start hearing sort of big round numbers in politics, right? If you were to do sort of evidence-based policy making, you probably wouldn't come up with exactly 10,000 places at a cost of exactly 10 million quid. That seems like the kind of thing that you're doing because you're looking for a public relations attitude rather than because it's based on what is required. They announced 10 grand, I beg your pardon, they announced 10,000 new places in the prison system back in 2016, of course. Liz Truss did that when she was at the MOJ. She did it with a plan for 2020. She then shifted that to 2023. Then she reduced it to, I think, 3,320. Now it seems that these new places are on top of those places. So the current 10,000 places that are needed as a response to the new law and order policy is on top of the old law and order policy, which already hasn't had its places put in. Yeah. So I might suggest at this point that this is just a bunch of myth.
Did they really say 10 million?
What, for the money?
For the 10,000 places.
Yes.
Because that works out at £1,000 per prison place. So
money is not just for the place itself. It would also be for, you know, security systems around the prison and
I'm saying it's too little enough. It's patently too little,
but even then it's not enough. And of course this is also part of the thing that if you really give a shit about this stuff, it's no good just having a place. The main problem that we have with prisons right now is prisoners spend 23 hours on average in a cell, and part of the reason for that is even when you build a decent library, even when you put good services there to attain qualifications, there aren't enough prison guards to take them to the place. So on that basis, you the worst thing you can do with prisons is just do this endless public relations exercise. What you need to do is sit down and think, how do we make this thing actually work? And on that basis, you're never going to get it, and you can tell you're never going to get it when they come up with these big round numbers.
But is it just about sort of dominating the information space then? You know, if you kind of Google Brexit news and you get 50 identical Express articles just hammering the idea that they're doing stuff.
I would more say that they think, look, there's a general election coming, it's obvious that they do, and law and order is one of the things you would do if you want to get the kind of people out that he wants to get out. He knows that once Parliament gets back, it's just Brexit until the end of time, so you've got the summer to just try and bludgeon home some of these core non-Brexit messages, and that's where this stuff is coming from.
So new prison places are like the strawberry mivy of politics, summer while you're off school.
Yeah. Also, you have to take all of this with a pinch of salt, of course, because just a few weeks ago I sat in this room saying, actually, the MOJ's got the only sensible Secretary of State that they put, and he is still sensible, but nevertheless, that is the area that already looks most tits up.
This idea of bailouts for companies threatened by no deal, I promise you a bit of Hayek. Didn't Hayek say that economic nationalism is the other road to political serfdom because you end up subordinating the entire economy to the political leadership?
Yeah.
Well, so essentially, you know, it's not the kind of thing that if you've got a picture of Margaret Thatcher with candles next to it on your mantelpiece, you should be going for bailouts.
Hayek supported freedom of movement. He didn't believe that states should have the power to control their borders against people. So he has plenty of quite liberal, you know, ideas. And of course, the thing is, no one's really a Hayekian. Like, you know, George Bush would have said, oh, I believe in free markets. I believe in, you know, Hayek, blah, blah. The second that you actually get a financial crisis, they're like, okay, should we chuck some money at the banks? Everyone's a Keynesian in a crisis. And with this, I would never take their statements of loyalty to Hayek too far, because they never live up to them.
I'm going
to
make the everyone's a Keynesian in a crisis mugs and make them available very soon.
And a T-shirt.
And T-shirts, yes.
I'd love one, genuinely.
Pay what you can afford to pay, subsidised by the podcast. You know me. The strategy is clearly to try and brand no deal as inevitable. That this is going to happen and there's nothing you can do about it. What's best for Britain doing to undermine that argument?
Well, our entire existence has been around saying that Brexit is not inevitable, and Best for Britain started at a time when the legacy Strong Green campaign had come out for soft Brexit and was saying, well, Brexit must be inevitable and therefore we need to make it least bad. And Best for Britain said no. So this is just an extension of what we've been doing for years anyway. So we have got a big no to no deal campaign happening at the moment. I suspect the Venn diagram of people who listen to this podcast and read The Sun on Saturday isn't huge overlap, but this weekend The Sun got hold of a leaked Best for Britain strategy document and exposed us being these dreadful centrist Ramonas trying to target lots of Conservative held seats in the south and southeast of England, where we know that people
big
are very
scoop,
pro-Remain,
huh?
and what we're really trying to do is to make it electorally toxic for that MP to do nothing. So it's not good enough for them to just sort of, you know, keep quiet and you know, let other people do the dirty work for them on trying to stop No Deal. They need to make like Philip Hammond has done today and get very active in trying to block it. And we think that that will be pretty successful. Those MPs are now caucusing better than they were. And we're pretty confident that they'll do the right thing when the House sits again in September. But we're also not neglecting the Labour Leave seats in predominantly the, if you're listening, son, you might as well just make notes, the Northwest, Yorks and Humber and West Midlands. So we're you know, making sure that there's plenty of pressure happening there. And that's both a ground campaign and an air campaign. So plenty on No Deal. But I think also the thing that's gone underreported.
What's an air campaign?
Well, that's where you're doing the, it's rather than having people going out and knocking on the door and doing ground stuff. It's all the rest of it, whether it's, you know, digital media or
we're not going to drop pamphlets with a plane like in...
No, we'll have some foot soldiers doing it. But yeah, no, can't quite afford the planes just yet. Working on it though, and you can go to betterwritten.org/donate if you think you can help us with an airdrop. But the thing that I think has gone underreported is US Congress on No Deal. And actually, just as we started recording, somebody sent me Nancy Pelosi's latest statement. And this is all around anything that puts at risk the ceasefire in Northern Ireland, any kind of Brexit, and of course the Brexit that our current administration is really advocating, of course, does tear up the Good Friday Agreement pretty much wholesale. They've said that they will block any UK trade deal going through Congress if peace in Northern Ireland is put at risk. So all this nonsense, all this Bolton Johnson willy waving over, you know, this, you know, UK's first in line for a great deal, is not in their gift to give. And the Democrats in particular, but also some notable Republicans, particularly those from Irish descent, are all saying no way are we going to do anything that helps the UK out if the UK threatens peace in Northern Ireland. So I think that's a really important issue that will help to spike No Deal.
Interestingly, in another aspect of Britain's charm offensive to the rest of the world, this week we saw the government unilaterally pulling UK diplomats out of committees with the EU before we've even, if we ever leave, left. Is there any justification for that apart from the optics back home? It really did seem to be like a kind of theatrical flounce simply to make the government look hard.
I just think this is, we're just seeing the failure of their like brash macho posturing. We're probably going to see more kind of authoritarian gestures out of them, suggesting that the government is in control. The more apparent it becomes that really it isn't. But yeah, they didn't turn up to one of the last ones either under the May administration. So this isn't actually that new.
Okay. Alex, another thing we saw in Chaff Week, in, you know, Release Countermeasures Week, look, there's a lot of stuff flying around in the air, was Michael Gove's Rapid Rebuttal Unit. Three more from them after the news, which is going to take on inaccurate media reporting of No Deal. Hilariously, this was reported in The Telegraph, which has turned out more inaccurate reporting of No Deal than anything apart from The Express. What did you make of that?
I mean, don't be mean. The Telegraph polled their readers and found 80% of them support the Rapid Rebuttal Unit. I've got the quote here, and it's quite brilliant. So a spokesperson said, this is to counter scare stories about No Deal. While No Deal may present some challenges, scare stories and misinformation are designed to obstruct democracy and prevent us leaving. Now, Number 10, Ian will correct me if I'm wrong, but the press unit in Number 10 would do this anyway if they thought a story that was untrue was out there about No Deal causing
whichever
panic.
Department was personal.
So as far as I can see, this is just announcing an intention to be sort of extra belligerent and active about it, with probably the view to making journalists self-censor before they even put out a story about No Deal, because they just don't want the extra hassle of Gove on the phone going...
Is it supposed to be directed at the journalist, or is it supposed to go public? Is the rapid rebuttal going to be a public thing, or is it via a telephone to the journal?
It's a media thing. It's targeting stories in the media that they think are...
No, I mean, they rebut, do they do it over the phone to the journalist, or do they do it publicly?
I would imagine both. I would imagine if their job is to put a lid on stories about No Deal that are they consider dangerous for public optimism. I mean, this is so Orwellian, isn't
terrifying.
It's extraordinary.
Is it Orwellian and terrifying, or is it just more bloody keep calm and carry on posters? I mean, it's essentially that, isn't it? It's like, don't worry, Britain, It's all going to be fine. It's all soothing music. Gonna be fine.
I can't. Yeah. I can't wait until they call me. Yeah. That would be like all my Christmases come at once.
This whole current government could be represented by that meme of the dog having a cup of tea in the burning room, couldn't it? Going, it's fine.
Look, everything they do is demonstrative. It's all reactionary virtue signalling. From the, you know, the countdown clocks going down to the rebuttal unit. None of it to the diplomats. None of it has any content whatsoever. It is just there. Because it is like we said last week, it's a government made up of Brexit Twitter, and it behaves like Brexit Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's demonstrating its virtue in this area, but it never actually does anything to secure it.
Which doesn't really, I mean, I'm not a fan of the guy, but it doesn't seem very Cummings. It doesn't seem very, because, you know, the Cummings is about sort of micro-targeting. You know, he's presented this idea that, like Ozymandias in Watchmen, he sits in a room full of televisions absorbing, or like the man who fell to Earth, you know, absorbing data from a billion different sources, which can then be micro-targeted at groups of 300 or 500 people. Just marching out and announcing a gigantic government policy that's never going to happen doesn't seem very Cummingsy.
Because I saw it, my suspicion is that it's not so much that they know which way this ends. I'm sure they would like to do the Singapore, would do the election for after the blah, blah, blah. I suspect that what they're thinking right now is just hold the position, deliver this kind of messaging. Once we get a certain amount of pushback from Parliament, maybe Parliament stops them, or maybe just Parliament just does even a motion that it will be enough for them to go, you know, in a flounce, just be like, oh, that's it. Parliament's getting in the way of the will of the people. We'll have an election now. So all of this is really just to make that, cement that narrative in place, so it is then in position for when something takes place, an event that leads to an election.
So it goes back to what Ian was saying, I think. It actually is in place to disguise the weakness of their underlying fundamental position, which in terms of numbers in Parliament is even weaker than it was before. Yeah. So they're basically trying to front it out.
Yeah.
And a part of that was the Telegraph poll on supposed public support for no deal, which was presented as 54% of people support Boris's plan to suspend Parliament.
A big no-no for polls, by the way,
yeah,
to personalise it like that.
Yeah, and absolutely. What it drove a coach.
The Christian name of the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
What mad methodology expertise have you used?
But even on their own figures, it was only 44% of people who said that that Boris should use whatever means necessary, even the prorogation of Parliament. They just left out the don't knows, didn't they?
And it wasn't just the way they phrased that particular question that is highly questionable. Peter Kellner, who's the former president of YouGov, had a really good piece on it yesterday in the New European. It's worth going and reading. And he explained that the preceding three questions totally lined it up to
softeners.
Get the comfort poll answer that they got in that Boris one. So it was all stuff about, you know, do you think it's absolutely abominable that the Queen would be dragged into all of this, yes or no? You know, so it was the entire poll was pretty dreadful.
You know, we've also had airlifts of food and medicines all sort of floated as if they're a good thing. One Twitter user, Edwin Haywood, worked out that the entire fleet of the RAF could shift 1.3 million tonnes of goods a year if it flew twice a day all day, which is 1.2% of what sea freight brings in. So again, that seems to be more kind of performative kite flying. Just in summary, before we move on, we've just sort of laughed heartily at all these moves to make no deal seem inevitable, but do we think it's getting traction with real voters? Do we think they are buying it?
Absolutely, I think they are. Absolutely. Like, I've heard from various people now, various friends who will say in my workplace, everyone just says, well, no deal is definitely going to happen now. It's extraordinarily effective, and that is not just them being effective. It is basically lots of people who are quite Remainy, who are opposed to no deal, having this instinctive sense of defeat. And we've talked about this on this programme before for years now, for about 3 years, in fact, since, you know, 2016. I feel like sort of progressive types, lefties, centrists, you know, even moderate Tories, have this sort of feeling as if they're constantly being out-strategized by these geniuses. And every time you see these supposed geniuses on the TV, you're like, you're a fucking buffoon.
Yeah.
Like, how could anybody have decided that you're going to be so effective? And yet there's this instinctive sense of we're always going to lose. And that right now is the main reason why you could lose, because you have that sense of defeatism to you.
So obviously we're doing our utmost on this podcast, but how else can we turn that around out in the world? I mean, Naomi, you discussed the campaigns that Best Britain is putting together. How do we get that message out there that this is not inevitable?
Well, you just cling to objective reality, which is just, I mean, I would not be sat here saying, everything's going to be fine if you're actually not going to be fine. Like, I'm not, frankly, over this podcast, have not been well known for my optimistic disposition. You know, the thing is, objectively, it is the case that there are ways to stop it. And objectively, it is the case that actually even the coordination problems you have around MPs are not insurmountable. And objectively, it is the case that the votes are there in the country, whether it's in a general election or a referendum, to stop these things. And none of that objective reality has gone away. Objective reality is the greatest friend to people who want to be able to think independently in any context. And the main thing to do is you go, what is it? And if it is, as it is right now, actually quite positive, you can afford to let go of all these really nasty nightmares that are swirling around everywhere.
I was sorry, you go now.
Well, I was just going to say, if listeners want to do concrete things, then the really important thing to do is to contact the Remain parties in your constituency, whether that's the Greens, Plaid, Lib Dems, Labour, others, and talk to them and say, for God's sake, do a deal. If we are facing a general election, we would so much rather that I could just vote for one of you in the safe knowledge that you will defeat the Brexit Party candidate or the Conservative candidate. So that's a very real and concrete thing. Find out who they are, Google them, get their email addresses, write to the local party chairman, write to the local paper about it, call into the local radio station about it. Say that that's what you want, because Ian's right. We have got the numbers in the country and we've got them for a general election and a referendum. But the problem we've got is Remain votes being split across four or five parties and Leave votes being concentrated in two. It's always been our problem, still is.
OK, we'll have time for some more optimism later in the podcast. But firstly, let's clear our minds after all that lot. With Gone in 60 Seconds, this is where one of our panel takes a favourite Leaver argument and in just precisely 1 minute pulls it to pieces so it can never, ever be put back together again. This week it's Naomi's turn and she's going to do "The EU is doomed as a political project, so we need to leave or we'll go down with the ship." Naomi, your 60 seconds starts now.
Well, blocs all over the world are facing difficulties. We just need to look at China and Hong Kong as one example, but the EU is actually doing really well. Even its most recent opponents like Salvini have long since shut up about leaving it. The turmoil surrounding Brexit has made voters in other countries more appreciative of the EU's benefits, and this led to a really energetic campaign across the continent in May that resulted in the first ever increase in turnout at a European election. The EU is clearly on the up, and since the 2016 referendum, they've negotiated successful trade deals with Canada, Japan and Singapore. And all of this has helped the European Union's popularity amongst its citizens jump to the highest levels in a decade, just as trust in member states' governments is dropping. And while polls show that the EU is much more popular among young people and those on the political left, about 45% see the bloc in a positive light and only 17% in a negative one, the highest net positive rating since 2009. And a full 61% are optimistic about the union's future, and 56% the most in 15 years fill their voice counts in the EU.
57 seconds.
Nice. Boom! Am I the winner?
I think you stuck the landing there.
Am I at the top of the leaderboard?
No, I've done 56.
He did 56.
Oh. Why didn't I know that before?
Well, you can try it next time.
That's unfair, everyone.
Is this going to be like the omelette on Saturday Kitchen or something?
It's going to be like the omelette on Saturday
Kitchen. I'll get you next time, Andrew. I'll get you next time.
Fantastic. Okay, we've all heard a lot of offers over the past few years, from sunlit uplands to no downsides, just considerable upsides to your very own pet unicorn. But here's a real one. How does the offer of free beer sound to you? It's a special thank you to all listeners from Beer 52, the world's best craft beer club and long-time, much-loved supporters of Remainiacs. All you need to do is go to beer52.com/remain to get your case of carefully chosen craft beers for free. All you pay is £4.95 for postage. And if you sign up in the next 2 weeks, you'll get an extra 2 beers. That's 10 in total. Beer 52 is the best way to discover your favourite new brew. Every month they'll send you a case of exciting craft ales, lagers, porters, saisons and all kinds, with a different theme every time. They've covered everywhere from Germany to Korea to South Africa, and they're big supporters of the UK craft beer scene too. I've been using it for ages and it's getting me through Brexit. And we've got some to try today. Here's the beers. There you go. Sound effects. Ooh. Foley artists. All right. Naomi, what have you got? And how's
I've it? Got Freedom of Movement, which is a black lager.
Fantastic. There you go. See, just about very on theme.
Oh, and it's got a lovely map of Northern Ireland on the back of it as well. So
it's a beer that was made for you. Ian, what have you got?
It's called Greater Consumer Rights. Mm. It's very nice. I really like the way the beers aren't so manly anymore. And now they have like these cool, funky designs and different colours and broom. Like, I quite like that there's a whole culture of
it. Yeah, it's kind of.
You could probably drink it on the tube and get away with it because no one would think you were actually drinking alcohol. Bad.
Absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. How is that a good point?
Because it means you can drink on
that's
the tube.
That's a good point.
Which
that's
part
a good point.
Unclear.
You can break the rules and be an alcoholic in public now. This is great.
Oh my God, you're so good, Alan.
I have O Vienna. in collaboration with the Bevoc Brauhaus. And it's an amber ale brewed with Vienna malt.
Means nothing to me.
It's delicious.
You've got to say that.
It's delicious. That's all that matters.
Well, I'm about to take a slug of United We Can by the Moore Beer Company, a pale ale showcasing European ingredients. Here we go.
Yay!
Yum.
Good. Oh, that's great. It's like being abroad. God.
No, it's good. It really is, actually.
I am a subscriber to Beer 52, and you get some weird stuff. You got Dunkin' Donuts coffee porter at one point, which actually tasted like coffee.
Really?
And porter. Unbelievable. So,
was that nice?
Yeah, it was, actually. Yeah, really enjoyable. So, go to beer52.com/remain to get your free case and start discovering great craft beers today. Especially for Romaniacs listeners, your first case contains beer from all over Europe. So you can say Prost, Sante, Yamas, and cheers to European unity any old way you like. You also get a copy of Ferment magazine and a free snack too. Your first case is free and you'll only be charged from your second onwards, and you can cancel at any time. So that's a free case of 8 beers, and if you sign up in the next 2 weeks, you get an extra 2 more beers for free as well. All at beer52.com/remain. Now, the Brexit 50p, aka half a sovereignty. back in the hazy days...
That is one of your best ones.
Back in the hazy days of Theresa May, who thought we would miss them so, Philip Hammond trailed a Brexit coin as a one-off limited edition collector's item for the sort of person who's happy to pay 10 quid for 50p's worth of national pride, a bit like those Franklin Mint Harry Potter coins that are only legal tender at Gringotts, or an Esso petrol coin featuring a bas-relief of Gaza for the 1994 World Cup that England didn't qualify for. Well, those wimpy days of Great British can't do are gone. Free spending Baron Brexit Sajid Javid intends to release millions of pounds worth of the patriotic heptagon into your pocket, all bearing the possibly inaccurate legend peace, prosperity, and friendship with all nations. Eds, please check. You'll be getting them whether you like it or not, so we thought we'd come up with some ideas of what to do with the coin nobody's calling the shiny Boris. Alex, firstly, is Sajid Javid just trolling us here? Is he rubbing our noses in it? Blue passports aren't enough.
Oh, he's just trying to fit in, poor Sajid, isn't he? I bet he was bullied at school by people like Johnson and Raab. I bet you that's what it is.
A Brexiter would say, well, there was a 50p to celebrate the anniversary of us joining the EU in 1998, so why not want to mark us leaving? They would say...
For the same reason that people don't register for gifts when they get divorced, because celebrating the failure of a relationship is just plain weird.
The 1992 50p to commemorate the founding of the single market now goes for £50 online, though, so it's actually done better than sterling, so we should all have piled into that one. If people get a Brexit 50p and their change, Alex, is there a place they should send it or spend it that will make a difference? What should they do with it? Who would you like to see the 50p's go to?
I reckon they should melt them and turn them into musket balls, because 16th century ammunition, I suspect, will be important in No Deal Britain.
Okay, this is what happens when you have beer drinking in the middle of the podcast. What about a worthy cause that could use the 50p? Apart from us.
Sure, there are loads of worthy causes.
What do you think is the most appropriate?
They can give their regular 50p's to them. I don't understand. Maybe they should just issue loads of those 50p's and give them to people for free as a form of quantitative easing, because Lord knows we'll need it.
Well, I had a kind of a reverse idea on that, which is if you get a Brexit 50p, you should drop it down the grid, because you'd then be limiting the money supply in a kind of DIY monetarism, in the kind of thing Mrs. Thatcher would have approved of.
That is so elitist.
Reading Hayek this week? What's happening over there?
I'm having a crisis, Ian. I'm having a crisis.
I can't afford to lose all the 50p's. So very important to me.
Listeners, send them to Alex. But of course, if you donate the 50p to a worthy cause, they get the benefit. But then it goes back into circulation. Somebody else gets it, and they can also re-donate it.
Is my local laundrette a worthy cause?
Yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah? Naomi, yeah. you're gonna say send your Brexit 50p to the Best of Britain, aren't you?
No, please don't. I mean, as an anti-monarchist Republican, coins, you know, propagating cultural conformity and an ideology that I don't believe in isn't especially new to me. So, you
Hand
know,
over
here we
your
go.
Money right now, come here, give me your money.
Look, given who's going to be calling all the shots for us when Trump bullshits himself to death, maybe we could call it the 50 Mike Pence.
Oh, God. Very good.
Groan. I mean, look, it wasn't our first Euro 50p, as you've already said. And actually, we were looking on eBay to see what those go for now, just before I came on the show. And if you find one of those ones from 73, you can get, what did you say, about 55 quid online?
Well, the 1992 one is 50 to 55 quid.
Right. No, apparently the 1973 one. I think they're going for, we cranked out about 89 million of them in 73. And now you can get a tenner for one if you okay. find that, which coincidentally is what Britain intends to call the new £20 note.
The tenner, very good, yes. Listener Ellis Pratt reminded us that the suffragettes made good mileage out of defacing coins with votes for women. Back in the day, they were chiselling votes for women onto the money. I mean, that, which is a bit more useful than drawing a beard on the Queen or making it look like Frankie Howard, you know, there is, which has been done. Is, I know a few enterprising Lib Dems produced hexagonal bollocks to Brexit stickers to put on your Brexit 50p.
Yeah.
Are these worthwhile things?
Yeah, and they make people feel good, and that's always worthwhile.
Mm. Engineering of people's mm-hmm. kind of, yeah. I believe, you know, mass self-care or something like that.
That's very Cummings.
And
Goings.
Cummings and Goings, yes.
Not like your new sitcom.
We're going to back that for a future show headline. Ian, as a man who once said he didn't care what colour his passport was, I'm guessing you don't care very much about Brexit 50p.
I don't give a fuck.
Javid said he wants us to put the coin on generally so that everyone gets a coin and it's not just a tribal thing that some people buy. But the whole point is it is tribal. It's saying, you know, we won and we're going to make you see this every time you buy half a packet of crisps.
It's government by trolling, which is exactly what we were discussing before. This is everything they're doing is the same thing. It's just government by trolling, and that's what this is. So you can get upset about it. You could just be like, oh, I couldn't give a fuck.
Yeah, whatever. There is a certain irony that the new coin was announced the same week that the Paddington 50p, mm-hmm. with an illegal immigrant from darkest Peru on it, was released. And Paddington doesn't earn £36,000 a year, I can tell you that, for nothing. No. So, I mean, if you're being objective, if you had to send your Brexit 50p somewhere, where would you send them?
I would probably send it JCWI, to the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, which is basically my default charity thing, you know, whenever there's a bet or something or something like that and I have to give it. That's usually where it goes. The Paddington thing is interesting, by the way. You know, Colin Yao, who's probably, he's the best immigration lawyer writing about immigration law, has a long blog, which if you look, Colin Yao, Paddington Bear,
goes
through in detail exactly what the Lib Gobs to call is that Paddington Bear would have faced if he tried to come to Britain and get a visa, which would have been considerable. In fact, he wouldn't have been able to get
here. He's a bear, so wouldn't he have been destroyed for having his temper?
Rabies.
No, that's true. We shouldn't take the metaphor too far. thank you so much.
Yeah, but if he was a humanoid bear, what kind? So he would have to demonstrate the ability to support himself? Just please look after this bear is not really going to fly.
No, that's not going to go so well with UK Border Force. That's not going to work out. But that does sort of tell you something, right? Because, you know, that, do you remember when we had Joel and Jason on? And
yes.
We were talking.
Who co-wrote Paddington.
And they talked about, you know, what this beautiful sort of vision of British values, basically. This idea of, like, please and thank you. Can you please be kind? And can you look after people? And that's in there. That's in the national personality. There's not like some made up hokey bullshit. That is in there somewhere if you can dig it out. And if you compare that sentiment, that classic sort of Paddington Bear sentiment, to then the reality of British immigration controls, you see how far away from our best characteristics we have drifted. So even though it is this sort of, if you look at that blog, even though of course it is a nonsense and a silliness, there is actually something in there that's sort of quite profound and quite upsetting.
But the thing about fiction is, it's true. Mm-hmm. You know, fiction tells the truth, doesn't it? It's kind of, it's there to sort of tell us about our world. Getting back to reality, though, I mean, the irony, another irony of the Brexit 50p coin is it's probably not going to happen at all because the Privy Council doesn't meet until October after whatever is supposed to happen has either happened or hasn't happened.
They'll cancel all their leave and holidays and bring them back or something.
Right, because it
doesn't
matter.
They're very tough.
Because it won't happen in the same way that the prison places are
will happen.
There is no objective reality to any of the things that we're discussing. They are basically press releases. That is all that they are. And the sum total of their intended effects is the emotional response that people had as they were announced. That is all they fucking are.
Yeah. So you actually, you don't need to do the thing. You just need to say the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Would it, if the coin ever happens, would it hasten the decline of the cash economy, you think? Cash. Cash is leave. Contactless is remain. Because actually, being serious about it,
there's probably quite a bit of truth in that. Actually.
But young people don't know what money is. I mean, a number of times I've tried to buy a pint and I'm standing there with my tattered fiver. And they've already presented the card machine, and they're like, what is this strange blue paper which you present to us?
I've often thought that Shelter, the homeless charity, should be handing out, you know, the contactless iZettle receivers so that homeless people can take contactless payments because they're sat outside a tube station going, can you give me some change? And I'm like, no, of course I don't.
Yeah. Just in conclusion on this, if you'd presided over a 25% decline in the value of sterling, would you want to draw attention to money Is that the thing that you would do? Say, hey, guys, let's all think about money for a bit. Because the first thing that happened was, it's the new Brexit 50p, now worth 20 euro cents. Ho, ho. Literally everybody made that joke. It does seem, even at the level of what you were describing, Ian, of virtue signalling and point making and, you know, kite flying a flag waving, it kind of failed.
And it's true, especially now, because with the sterling slide in the last couple of weeks, the average family of four doing an average holiday in Spain saw the cost of that holiday go up by 700 quid while they were there. So everyone is, you know, everyone knows, everyone's feeling it. You're right. It may as well be a chocolate coin.
So in conclusion, the bastards have ruined money as well now. Okay, let's do boring but important of the week, where one of our panellists picks out something that we should all be paying attention to instead of worrying about how to exchange their hated shiny Boris for a lovely silver Paddington instead. Ian Dunt, what's boring but important this week?
Again, I'm just going to point out that I think I disproportionately get the boring but important.
because you bring them alive, darling.
You make them live.
No, I'm sure that's what it is.
You bring out their soul. Come on, what's boring but important?
It's modular trade deals. So...
Of course, listeners.
Come on, of course it is.
Well, because look, this is what, you know, it's said by John Bolton and, you know, the British government over the last few days, is we can do this thing with the US by just splitting up a trade deal and doing it in little bits. The question is, like, can you make that work? There's a bunch of different levels to that. I mean, the first level is, can you do it sort of strategically? Can you do it in terms of getting the thing in the negotiating room itself? And the answer is you sort of could at the early stages. I mean, when you take... Bolton, who wouldn't be doing the negotiating, by the way, Bolton mentioned sort of industrial goods. And the thing is that after the various rounds of multilateral trade negotiations that have taken place through the GATT agreement, through the WTO, tariffs on industrial goods are pretty much fucking gone. Like, there's very, very few large tariffs on them. So on cars, I think the US right now is 2.5%. Britain, because of the EU tariff, is 10%. So you just go there and you go, fine, right, so we're going to do the cars. US would happily get rid of its 2.5, couldn't give a fuck, especially if you're getting 10% back. So you could very quickly come back with there'll be no more tariffs on cars, which of course would be greeted by the press here as like, look at how easy it is to suddenly get rid of it. It doesn't really mean anything. Where it means stuff is when you get onto areas that the US cares about. They care about pharmaceuticals, they care about Silicon Valley, and
healthcare.
And overwhelmingly, they care about agriculture. Their farmers will want something. And that brings in all of the problems that we usually have about sort of animal welfare standards. And the thing that we don't mention enough in their agriculture, which is the overuse of antimicrobials, which is catastrophically terrible the way they do it. And Europe has much, much more sensible rules there. Once you try to get onto an area where they are not willing to budge, they are not going to fucking budge. And that's where things get difficult. That'll be later on. And then the second part is, what happens when you bring it back? As Naomi said, you've got fuck all chance in Congress if you have decided to do something that involves no deal that has threatened Ireland. Same way, I think you don't have much of a chance in the British Parliament or among the British public. When you look at what happened with the EU and the US when they tried to do their trade deal, it all came down to this thing, which is admittedly pretty fucking shady, of these investor trade dispute mechanisms. It's a sort of secretive investor courts attached, you know, to governments. And that doesn't make for pretty reading, let alone by the time... And that, by the way, caused actual popular upset. That was genuinely a popular thing. People were upset about it. Let alone by the time you get onto chlorinated chicken and blah, blah, blah. Then the final part is, and this to me is the most interesting part, because we've seen something genuinely fascinating in the sort of worldwide populist right-wing movement this week, which is that, remember, the US hates the WTO. In fact, Trump today was threatening to leave it. They've been trying to destabilize it. They've basically killed off its blood supply by stopping there being any more judges going on to the appellate court, basically stopped it from functioning. The UK, especially Brexiters, have been acting like the WTO is their great friend. Now, if you have modular trade deals, it is not legal through the WTO. You can be litigated against. Now, I don't think you would be. But the UK's attitude was supposed to be, we are going to now really base ourselves on being in the WTO and making it work. Yeah, yeah. Now, what the US is saying is, no, you're not.
Yeah.
You're going to be joining us on the anti-WTO front. So what you saw this week was already a sort of a vision of the future after Brexit of, oh, it's not just Europe that's a threat to sovereignty. It's the WTO that's a threat to sovereignty as well.
Can I ask something? Taking what Naomi was saying before, you know, Pelosi's speech in the Irish Parliament and her more recent statement today. Is there a possible future where we've basically alienated the EU and we're in the middle of trade negotiations with the US at a time the presidency changes and they see... basically Brexit as aligned with Trump and they want nothing to do with it and they want to hug the You Closer again, we're left adrift without either.
Yes, absolutely. But then it wouldn't make any difference because the US-UK trade deal is only worth 0.2% of our GDP anyway. So, I mean, it would be embarrassing, you know, but then we live in a world of embarrassment. This is something we're used
to
right now.
We're beyond embarrassment.
Exactly.
Now.
So, but economically, it would make absolutely
in terms of influence, a US trade deal is not unimportant, though, because being close it will give us a little bit of, say, we'll amplify our international.
I don't quite agree, because I just think most of that stuff happens outside of trade. Like, there was no UK-US trade deal, you know, when we were very close, for instance, with Thatcher and Reagan, or with Blair and Bush. You know, that's the politics.
So, in summary, we're not just leaving Europe, we're going to leave the world as well. Exit Brexit planet Earth.
That's the danger, isn't it?
But only England and Wales.
Here comes the optimistic bit. We're going to try and break the habit of a lifetime by ending on an optimistic note. It does feel like we're in the end game, but opponents of hard Brexit are finally getting their act together. We talked about Phil Hammond attacking No Deal, Burko saying he'll ensure Parliament will get a say. Tom Watson is working with Joe Swinson, and we're promised no confidence moves pretty as much as soon as Parliament returns. First up, though, aren't we in a catch-22 wherein no election means No Deal remains the front runner, but an election runs down the clock and is more like it could even happen after No Deal? So whatever happens, No Deal continues to be likely, election or no election.
I don't know about that, really. I mean, I would have thought an election is winnable. I mean, Naomi's would be better talked to. It just seems to me it is simply winnable. If someone was to say to me right now, put all of your money on one side or another, so it was stripped out of my actual prejudices and what I want to happen and just on what I need to happen financially, I would probably put it at about 50-50 which way that goes, because I don't think either Labour or the Tories are able to get a majority. So the question comes down to how can you coordinate that sort of thing. And on this matter, if he can set the date for the election after that jump, I don't think people should be going around acting like that would be like something, oh, maybe he's got this option to do it. He didn't fucking mention No Deal during the referendum. It's been voted in three times in Parliament this year alone. And Parliament, by the way, people seem to keep on forgetting this, is made up of the people that we elected to represent us. It's not like some kind of fucking
after the
body
referendum as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, 54% of people in the 2017 general election voted for parties that had explicitly ruled out No Deal. There is simply no mandate at all for it.
And this would come after a no confidence vote. Yeah. So all of that, he doesn't get it. He himself doesn't get elected. Then there's a no confidence vote. And then they're like, oh, and I can do it anyway. Mm. He's sort of thinking, like, we shouldn't act like that is an okay option for him to pursue.
I do like the way that you refer to October the 31st as the jump. Like it's hyperspace. Jump, like after we spin off the FTL and end up in the Gamma Quadrant or whatever. So,
event horizon.
Absolutely. So spreadsheet Phil breaking cover today and really coming out against No Deal. The attack on him from Cummings was savage. They treat him like the Emmanuel Goldstein of Brexit here. How significant is this? I mean, because, you know, he's been pilloried as the kind of the traitor in the nest up to now.
Well, the reaction is as a consequence of the significance. You know, they wouldn't be responding this badly if they didn't think it was really going to hurt them. It does. The Gawkward Squad, as they are coined, are active and working together and will not support Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings' strategy over No Deal. I think that a no confidence vote will probably get nixed by Johnson calling an election. Okay. I think that's what they'll do. I think they will get ahead of this. They won't want to have any kind of egg on their face and humiliation. All of the money that's being spent, we know what the Conservative Party is spending, and they're ramping up huge amounts of online advertising spending over the summer. They're investing an enormous amount in polling. They are doing everything that they can to make sure that they are as ready as they can be to get going once the pistol is fired. So, yeah, I mean, It's incredibly difficult for all of us. A general election it's high risk for Remainers. You know, we probably do have the numbers in the current parliament to get a final say vote through, but it's increasingly unlikely that that is going to be an option. We've got a government with a majority of one that's got other things it wants to do. All roads point to them getting ahead of this and calling an election on their own terms. I think, the Labour position is always going to be the really difficult one in all of this. And I think that the people close to Corbyn are probably almost hoping that the worst effects of No Deal get labelled very closely to the No Dealers in the Conservative Party so that they can sort of be the phoenix that rises from the ashes from it. But that said, they're not going to vote against overturning the fixed term.
But this is where what Ian was saying comes together with what you're saying, in that they want an election, but they want it to look as if they were forced to call it.
Yeah.
So he's desperate for someone to stop him from doing this thing, basically. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so it's the mask. Okay. Somebody stop me. Yeah. Tom Watson, Labour must work with Joe Swinson. This was at an OFOC event.
Yeah, yeah.
This is going to incense the Corbynists. They hate him already.
Indeed.
Do we think it's likely to move the dial? I mean, mysterious spokesman X and Rebecca Long-Bailey have let it be known that Labour's not going to back a national unity government unless it's led by Jeremy Corbyn, which will be a funny kind of national unity government. Is it going to move the needle? Or is it the long march of Tom Watson towards getting something done?
So Tom Watson's not the only Labour MP that's doing this. There are lots of them that are talking to the Remain Alliance, working with us on all of this. And there is nobody involved in the Remain Alliance that I've heard that would try to put up a Remain Alliance candidate against a sitting Labour MP who's brilliant on Europe. So, you know, all of this is happening whether the leadership of the Labour Party want it to or not. And the Remain Alliance will work around them to make sure that we deliver the goal, which is to make sure that Johnson doesn't have a big majority or any kind of majority following a general election. As I understood it, the particular detail of the Joe Swinson and Tom Watson thing about working together was on no deal, to fight no deal, rather than in a full-on stop Brexit Remain mm-hmm. alliance. So I think Tom still stays some distance from Joe's own position on Brexit in particular. But no, there's a lot of encouraging mood music coming out from lots and lots and lots of Labour MPs, and actually some people very, very close to the left of Labour and the Labour leadership. We've seen Owen Jones do a very big move actually in support of the Remain Alliance over the last few weeks, and Paul Mason as well. And in particular, Michael Chesham, who heads up Another Europe Is Possible, which is the group that have really led the whole Love Socialism, Hate Brexit, Love Corbyn, Hate Brexit agenda over the last couple of years, and have been doing brilliant work there. They're the ones that are pushing the CLP motions very hard up and down the country, and they've got 50 of those passed now ahead of the Labour Party conference, which actually, you know, go much further than the CLP motions did last year. It's not just about a referendum, it's about revoke and remain.
So how inextricable is this from the question of Jeremy Corbyn's continued leadership of the Labour Party, do we think, the panel?
Well, just don't let it go anywhere near that stuff. We're on... This is the actual fight now. This is what's about to happen. It's going to happen in a very, very tight period of time. The more we start thinking about with Jeremy Corbyn leader, so that is not going to change over the next few months. So that can't be what we're dealing with. The whole no confidence thing should be there as a nuclear option. But unfortunately, as soon as you actually do it, you start getting brought into that sort of debate you alluded to. Exactly. Who's the one in charge? If it's not Corbyn, he won't accept it. If it is Corbyn, the others won't accept it. So that just gets you into a debate that isn't helpful. There are plenty of mechanisms available to you, and they are explicit. They have been said. John Bercow said, use standing order 20. He's basically, I mean, almost
SO24.
Explicitly said it. Use standing order 24.
Of SO24.
Exactly. He can't be any clearer.
Any clearer.
You know, like he could do a performative dance for everyone, and that would indicate towards it. Use an emergency debate. We know right now that neutral motions, these things that previously could not be amended,
that he will allow them to be amended.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's all been made very clear. We've also got the Northern Ireland Act, which MPs themselves secured before Johnson came in, that puts these ministerial statements have to go to the Commons and you could have a vote then. There's also, by the way, if you use no confidence, there's two stages before the vote that you can use. The first one is, there's a single sort of business order, basically, which is when MPs vote on something to say how long they're going to take to talk about it. You can amend that if you want, put it in there. They've done that before. Or the actual no confidence motion itself, you can amend to say, well, fine, we want a general election, you know, before October 31st, or we want you to extend Article 50 and have a general election afterwards. That makes a no confidence motion kind of defunct for its original purpose, but it gets you your purpose, which is ultimately always going to be, we're going to set aside these days for a debate, pass legislation to force you to extend Article 50, just like they did last time. So we don't even need to go into the no confidence thing. There's plenty of guns there. Pick one of them up and shoot them.
And lots of Tory Remainers and you know, non-Conservatives that are just, you know, anti-Corbyn are very worried about anything that might empower Corbyn. But I can assure everybody that what Andrew said at the top was right. none of the parties at the moment can form a majority government. There is no cut of the data, no poll, none of it that shows that Corbyn is likely to return a majority Labour government. Mm. He will have to be in coalition with either or both of the Lib Dems and the SNP, depending on how the deals go and how many MPs each gets returned. So and the price for that from the Liberal Democrats will be a second vote.
Can I play devil's advocate for a moment? Because I don't disagree with a word of what either of you said, but psychologically, the first building block of any corporation, and this will require cooperation, is a level of trust. Mm. And it seems to me that there's a philosophical problem. Can you be dragged into a position and be authentic in supporting it with Corbyn? And also, this seems to me that under Corbyn and Seamus Milne, Labour has developed a reputation for a certain amount of duplicity. And that, I think, is a real psychological obstacle to remain getting together and stopping no deal. I feel from a lot of people that they don't know if they can trust the Corbyn leadership. Not two steps ahead or four steps ahead, but whether they will come together, announce something, and then unnamed spokesperson X will come out and say, well, no, that's not what we agreed.
It's funny because I think I'm about to say something quite supportive of Jeremy Corbyn. I don't feel fantastic. I actually feel quite ill in the bottom of my stomach. Ultimately, I would say look at how they've behaved in parliamentary votes. You're absolutely right. Every time, you know, spokesperson X gets a chance to whisper fucking toxic nonsense in a hallway in Westminster, he will. But let's look at the votes. And actually on that, Labour whipped in order to do this, and they have demonstrated that again and again. So on this bit, which isn't so much what happens in an election, it's what do you do on the votes to stop no deal? I just cannot see any world in which they do not whip to stop no deal.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we will find out as time goes by. But we've come to the end of the podcast, which means the Brexit time capsule. Usually our guest decides, but our panellists haven't had a chance in ages to choose something. Alex Andreo, it's your turn to choose something to put in the Brexit time capsule for Kate Hoey to play with. What's going in there?
I'm going to put Ian Duncan Smith in there.
Oh, God!
Knowing there is a risk they may breed. Because it seems to me it's the only way we'll ever be rid of him. He's like the Benjamin Button of politics. He's gone from leader of the opposition to secretary of state to senior minister to junior minister to irrelevant backbencher, and he still won't fucking retire.
So is he going to be head boy of a school and then president of the Dennis the Menace fan club?
Also, because the capsule is likely to be opened on an anniversary, which may be Halloween, it will be quite a nice scare for them, I reckon.
What, for Kate Harry?
The Mummy.
If Ian Duncan Smith and Kate Harry
and
pop
the kids
out.
Oh, God. Anyway, we always finish the show with a clip in a European language, and this week it's in German from listener Christina Pagel.
Oh, great. She's fantastic.
Wenn du diesen Clip spielst, dann werde ich definitiv bis zum Ende zuhören. Definitiv.
That means, if you play this clip, then I'll definitely listen to the end. Definitely. Good thinking, Christina. So, listeners, don't forget to send your European language clips to us. Record something on your phone and email it to us at info@romaniacs.com, and we will use the best ones. And that is the end of the show. Thank you to Naomi, Alex and Ian. Remember, next week's podcast is out late Friday, not Friday morning. So we will see you then. Here's our theme tune, Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and there's a free download on their website, ampleplay.co.uk, for all listeners. Now, please be upstanding as we thank our latest Patreon backers.
It's a big thanks from me to Nick Waddingham, Matt, Cullen Black, Cynthia, David Squires, Divya, Colm Linnean, and Alan Sinnott.
Hello, and many thanks to Chris Love, David Pearl, Aidan McGinley, Thomas Labadi, Daniel Gersh, Ashley Wynne-Jones, Andrew Rowley, and Tom Pegg.
And hello, thank you from me to Richard Herrick, Doug Whitelaw, Richard Moore, Tim Barr, Antonella Tassini, Bennett Griffin, John Godley, and Darren Waddle.
And finally, hello from me to Norman P. Shute, Adrian Dyke, Julie Cockman, Jay Aliff, Ali Willis, Anne-Marie Greenslade, Joshua Swirsky, and Jane Headland.
Romaniacs was presented and produced by Andrew Harrison with Alex Andreu, Naomi Smith and Ian Dunt. Audio production was by me, Elsie Barth, at Soho Radio. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.